Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, Johnny V is going to be here with us talking about food. Right now, I would like to welcome Jason Yersic. He is a poet and playwright, and he's going to be giving a reading along with Robert Mirabal this Friday, July 10th, in Taos at the Taos Art Plaza. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, thank you.
So your work, which we've been talking about on this show off and on over the years, and it's just wonderful to see you continuing to produce new books of poems and plays and so on. A lot of your work springs from a very rough childhood, and it seems like almost a miracle that you didn't end up having a much rougher and perhaps criminal life than you did. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your own background?
Sure. Yeah, it is a miracle that I am able to survive in the free world. I did have quite an extensive criminal background until I decided to change my path. And so, growing up, the way I grew up was in the streets, and my mother was a victim of alcoholism. And so, I spent a lot of time without any emotional support and without any guidance, being taught how to appreciate and to succeed. And so whenever I would get to a point where I was going to be successful, I would sabotage myself.
Right.
And that's pretty much, those were the habits that I began to develop. Rather than succeeding, it was self-destruction.
And meanwhile, your father was in prison and then he was killed.
Yes, exactly. He was killed when I was 8 months old. And my mother luckily remarried whenever I was 2.5 to 3 years old. But like I said, their lifestyle was one of indulging in alcoholic beverages, so they were largely unavailable for me.
And so where did you go from there, and how did you get out?
Where I went from there was violence, and I began the psychology of a criminal, whereas I shot at people. People shot at me. I got stabbed. I stabbed people. I used drugs and alcohol as a way to escape the emotional torment that I was feeling, because I would see people playing catch in the park with their father. I would see people playing on the swings with their brothers or sisters, and that left there was an emotional void for me in those areas, and so I used lashing out physically as a coping skill for that.
Were you a gang member?
I was never affiliated with the gang, but every person that I knew other than me in my neighborhood was in a gang. So being at such a young age, 2 to 3 years old, when I first became hanging around with the gangs, they didn't want to jump me in, and that's the only way into the gang. So I never got jumped in, but we were, comrades in arms.
Right, right. Now, when you somehow decided, what was the process of saying, wait a minute, I don't want this life and there are other choices?
Well, believe it or not, I had reached a point where I had sawed off a shotgun that my grandfather gave me, and I sawed the handle and the barrel off, and I had put the shotgun in my mouth, and I was getting ready to pull the trigger when I realized that I didn't want my parents to not understand why I had chosen to destroy myself in that manner. So I tried to write a suicide note, and I quickly realized that I didn't know how to say what I felt. And in the process of learning how to say what I felt, I became interested in expressing myself with words, and that led to poetry.
So the attempt to write a suicide note led you to be a poet?
Yes. When I finally got it, and it probably took about 18 months, and I finally got it to where it said what I felt like I wanted it to say, I showed it to somebody. And after they read it, I was expecting them to say, wow, you're going to kill yourself. I can't believe you're going to kill yourself. And they actually read it, got to the bottom of the page, and looked at me and said, that's a beautiful poem. And this light just came on inside of me, and I was like, a poem? This is a poem? And that led to writing more poems.
How old were you at that point?
I was 26 years old.
26
yeah.
years old. And so up until then, I mean, you did things like you were a professional, semi-professional boxer?
I was a professional boxer, yes.
What What was that like? I mean, I imagine when I sometimes, I'm not much of a boxing fan personally, but when I see people boxing on TV, I always wonder what their lives were like that they chose that.
Yeah. Well, I was at a house party one night, and I got into a street fight, and the guy said, "Hey, man, you should get paid to do that." And I was like, "Well, what do you mean?"
It wasn't the guy you were fighting.
No, it wasn't the guy I was fighting. It was a peer of mine, and he said, "You should get paid to do that. I'm at a boxing gym, and you should come down and learn how to box." And I thought, hey, I can get paid for this. So that's why I became a boxer, a professional boxer. But I was just trying to express those same things that I had expressed in my suicide note through the boxing. It was just, I wasn't taught to be book smart. I was taught to be violent. So it was a natural progression to get into the boxing ring once I realized I could get paid for violence.
Was there something cathartic about it? Or, I mean, did it advance you in any way?
The boxing, it did. Because in order to be the top boxer or a top opponent for anybody, it has to take on a spiritual aspect. You have to watch what you eat. You have to watch what you think. You have to watch your facial expressions. The training is very strict, and it's almost monk-like to be a boxer if you're gonna excel in the sport. So it was transformative in many ways.
But you still have to keep that passion of violence and wanting to hit people inside of you.
Yes, exactly. And I didn't realize until lately, but somebody explained to me, when I got my professional fight license, I thought, I'm a professional athlete. But what I really had achieved was a way to beat up people without getting into trouble. That was just the license saying, I'm allowed to beat people up now. And I didn't realize it at the time. I felt like I was achieving something. And I was actually just making it okay to hurt another person.
So then, 26 years old, this amazing sequence of events happened. You said, okay, I'm going to start writing poetry. Where did you go from there?
I just started writing like my life depended on it, because at that point, my life was depending on it. If I didn't create another piece after the suicide note that had the same effect on somebody when they read it as the first note, then I felt like I might possibly have to kill myself anyway. So every piece became a new suicide note, and I just wrote hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of suicide notes, and that's basically how the first manuscript came about.
So some of those, I mean, is that very first note you wrote included in any of your books?
It didn't make it to the cut.
Yeah,
the words were misspelled, the grammar was all messed up, the line breaks were very crude, so it didn't make it to the editing phase. Once I realized I was going to try to write a book, it wasn't in my mind for 2 or 3 years that I was going to write a book. It was just what I had found to do in order to survive. And then once I realized I could probably write a book out of it, then the poetry changed. The structure changed. The content changed a little bit.
We're talking to poet and playwright Jason Yersick. So did you have mentors or other poets or writers who recognized you and brought you along?
I did. I reached out for the help of Jimmy Santiago Baca by way of an email, and it took several emails to finally get him to agree to meet me. And then once he met me, we shared similar backgrounds in our lifestyles and in our upbringings. A few of the differences were he went to prison, and I was facing 16 years in prison at one point for a scuffle that I got into that included police officers. So I was facing 16 years in prison, but I never made it to prison, and he did, so I felt like we were basically the same, you know, brothers, if you would, brothers of the street.
And he's, of course, a well-known poet that probably many of our listeners have heard or read, and what was your relationship like? Did he teach you, I mean, about poetry and structure and language and things like that? Did you talk and hang out like friends?
Yeah, it was more of a friendly relationship. And how I was able to progress was he just allowed me to hang out with him. He allowed me to go to his readings. He allowed me to go to his workshops. He allowed me to travel with him and help him sell books. And it was up to me. I felt like it was up to me to learn what I could from just watching him. Because there wasn't very many conversations about you need to stylize your poem like this, or you need to say this here or that here. It was just more of, you're going to be hanging out with me now, and it's up to you to pick something up.
So, would you like to read one of your poems?
Yes, I'd love to. It is called Ode to Society. I want to bash, abuse, and batter you. until you become nothing, like you have bashed and abused and battered me, until I was nothing, had nothing, until the only job I can hold is a mindless job, where tendonitis creeps into my fingers, where you steal my spirit by the hour, you slowly steal my spirit. I want to torture, maim, and abandon you until you become a nameless villain scouring back alley dumpsters with grimy fingers, torn pants. The expression on your face will be one of utter hopelessness, looking for splinters of your decimated heart, fearing you will never piece it back together, seeking out anything that will give you hope, but finding nothing, as you have done to me. I want to force you to live in shadows where you lack the light to grow, in the maw of fear, force you to live when all you really want to do is die. I want to smash you and tell you you are nothing, have nothing, will always be nothing, will never have anything until you believe me, and the very blood of your life drains from you until you wind up in an intensive care unit with tubes coming from your lungs, straps holding you in, and the blood from someone who I feel is better than you is transfused, transforming you. You will have no idea how you got there until your very freedom is stripped from you, like a piece of bread from a poor kid's hand in a homeless soup-lined kitchen. I'm gonna tear you down slowly, gonna tear you away from your family and make you cry so hard, your tears will wash away everything that is left. Your dreams, sensitivity, uniqueness, creativity, all gone until you forget how to cry, how to do anything, until you forget your heart, your reason, your answer to why you continue to live, until you lose your mind, stick needles in your arms, wander the earth in search of crack rocks, and drink yourself to death, trying to escape this nightmarish horror I will create for you. Society, you have in me a bitter enemy who will stop at nothing to see you crumble, as you have done to me and my family, my people of poverty, for generation upon generation. You have in me a bloodthirsty killer that you yourself created. But instead of killing others born into your categories, I will kill you. I will kill you and feast on your wails, bathe in your tears, devour your laughter until it is gone and you can laugh no more. I will push your innocence further and further into your own margins of criminality until the ebb tide of sorrow pulls you under, until you breathe it in and it's all you know, like you have done to me, to my children, to my family, to mothers whose children moan and cry themselves to sleep every night with empty stomachs because their fathers are locked up for life. I'm gonna push you until you feel what it feels like to have no one there to hold you when you reach out.
Ode to Society by Jason Yersick. I mean, it's very powerful poetry, and it awakens in the reader, certainly in me, both empathy and that understanding that if you are not, you know, if I'm sitting here having a nice middle-class life and being in the cafe every day and not living the life that you lived, it's easy to ignore. But for you, it's impossible to ignore or to get out of it. And I would think that part of what fuels that anger is just the oblivion of such a large number of people.
Yes, definitely. Excuse me. When I go and I teach my poetry workshops and I share with people who are a little more, I don't know how to say it, a little more luckier than I am, with a better lifestyle and a different upbringing, it's really hard to bridge the gap because they just don't seem to believe that there's people out there that have hard lives, and it's really difficult. It gets really difficult. But today, for instance, I spoke at Cibola High School and I had a writing workshop, and the connection there was almost instantaneous with the kids that I spoke with, because they're looking for answers and there's not anybody telling them anything with sustenance that will help them. And so I'm able to go and share my story with them and share how I was able to express myself with poetry, and it gives them that little pinhole of light that I got when somebody said, my poem, my suicide note was a poem, that flash of light, I can see that happening to them as I share with them. So that's where I have found my love of life, is teaching.
So you teach, you give workshops, you talk to other people who maybe have had somewhat similar lives to you, and you also are starting to mentor individual young poets.
Yes, I have one particular young man from Taos. His name is Andrew, and I have a manuscript of his that I've been going over, and I think we're going to publish a book in late fall as of right now. He's doing some revisions, and hopefully he can get those underway.
Another thing that I thought about a lot while reading your book, Odes to Anger, is that on some level, you know, you want to get out of a life and a way of being and a way of thinking that you've grown up with, but it's very hard to make yourself into a new person, because those are the fibers that make up, you know, the baby, the child, the adolescent that you were, and you can't just throw it away. It makes up who you are, but so there's a conflict, and that comes through in a lot of your work.
Okay, good. I'm glad it does. Yes, it's difficult to, you know, I was a football player, or acclaimed football player before, and I wanted to be a professional football player. Those dreams fell through when I realized I had to go to college in order to achieve that. And then, you know, it moved over to boxing, and I had to change from a football player to a boxer. And then it changed from a boxer to a poet, and I had to move from a boxer to a poet. And those are very fundamental shifts in a person, to be able to get back and forth between those places. I don't really know how I did it, other than I just applied myself as best I could.
The whole center section of the book is a set of meditations on the breath. Did meditation itself play a role for you?
Oh, yes. The Buddha and, you know, Buddhist scripts and philosophy is pretty much my foundation for any spirituality that I partake in. My father was a nationally acclaimed sculptor. Whenever he was inside of the Santa Fe State Prison, he carved a picture, a sculpture of the Buddha, and he named it Siddhartha. That Buddha made it to my bedpost when I was 18 years old, and it was at then that I realized there had been messages and things left behind by my father that I needed to look for, and so I started following Buddhism after that, at that point.
And so these poems about the breath come from that, and the breath has really, in a way, become your friend and companion, and you write about the breath in the second person as if it were another, like a friend with you.
Yes. I didn't know it at the time, but when I started to compose the manuscript, a yogic tradition is to teach young children that their breathing element is their only friend in the world. No matter what, as long as you're alive, your breathing is going to be with you. And had I known that when I was writing the manuscript, it might have affected it a little bit. But I was just seeing it as what has kept me alive all this time. And when I broke it down to the smallest root that I could find, it was my breathing. So I just wrote poems to my breathing.
Would you like to read one of those?
Oh, sure. I don't know which one it's going to be yet. Okay, I'll just read number one. You are my oldest friend, truest companion, sweet breath. As a boy alone in gang-infested streets, alone in my mother's house of addiction, alone, you were so kind, for I had not been taught how to clean my mouth, and you continued coming through a pasty, sour place to nourish me, this ravaged soul. You stuck with me, even when I tried to hold you out, as I trembled from fear, cowering in the cold declivity of my home. You became abbreviated, shuddering. I watched you as you passed through others who were unaware of your blessing, like my sister and brother, their black encircled eyes of walking ghosts who came home to eat, but then quickly left again, having lost their childish simplicity long ago, the same way mine was taken each time they passed me by. Watching you and my mother, abandoned soul, while she lay, eyes rolled back, lifeless, passed out on a couch. You were so faint in her flesh pool, chest barely moved as I watched, a forlorn 5-year-old making sure you are still in her. I watched you and my stepfather passed out on the couch next to her, his kindness lost in the question, what have I gotten myself into? When I ran away, and I ran a lot, down to a park to watch slap boxing boisterous gangbangers, I don't remember breathing hard. I don't remember you being with me at all. I was in a vacuum while I watched them smoke weed, cigarettes, drink beer from my hiding spot, in bushes behind walls. My breath, I have forgotten you so many days of my life, left you alone as I was alone, and I'm sorry. I know how terrifying it is to be forgotten. Thank you for being here, even though it seems I don't want you sometimes. Thank you for fueling this shard-ridden heart and mixed-up mind to a place where we can be as one with pain, with shame. A place where I can accept my bruised and tattered self. Accept that even though my blood-crusted past was hard, I can have peace. There can be happiness in this life. Here with you, this breath, this moment.
Jason Yersick from the book Odes to Anger. The other thing that comes out in your book is the whole question of work and the kind of work you do, which on the one hand is rough and backbreaking and body destroying and soul numbing and all the things that you say about it. And on the other hand is really rich with metaphor and scope for contemplation.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it wasn't until recently when I started to realize through my Buddhist techniques that there's messages hanging on the wires, there's messages in the bolts that I try to pry apart with the wrenches, and I smash my finger on a piece of iron and my finger starts bleeding, there's a message there. And so once I started to decipher the messages, I realized that those were poems, and I began to write poems about it.
We've got just a little time left. Maybe you could read one of those.
Okay, I'd love to. Today I took apart the rear end of a semi-rig. I cut bolts, moved the axles forward, reconfigured brake lines. I thought about my mind. I took it apart too. With each grinder blade thought, bolt by bolt, piece by piece, I moved it forward. I cut the old frame apart with a cutting torch. I heard cruder levels of myself hissing through the torch tip, as bright orange molten metal popped, sprayed, splashed, burned my skin. I drilled holes for the axle mounts, heard the new me screaming when metal drill bits cut into metal frame. But making a new me was much harder than cutting the old away, than letting go of whom I've hated. I leaned full body into the drill, cutting slowly into double plate steel, my muscles tense, teeth clenched, anger percolating to my mouth with cuss words, full body sweat dampening. Curly shavings of myself gave way, slowly, carving a new foundation. Taking a break, I looked up to see a copper-headed sparrow on an overhead power line. Came to praise me. Praise this warrior I've become. It gave me courage to continue in spite of my hunger, grumbling stomach, and dry parched lips. My eagerness to let the old me drop away, to be taken to the junkyard, sold for scrap. The eagerness to let a new me emerge, ready to work on myself, grew larger, greater, bolt by bolt, piece by piece.
Jason Yersick. So what are you working on now?
I have a novel that I've been trying to tweak around for the last 6 years, and I finally took the basis of the novel and I began a new manuscript. And what I've been doing for the last, I'd say, 8 months is saving up words. And what I mean by that is Charles Bukowski said it best: when you write, you write, and when you're not writing, you save up the words, so when it's time to write again, you can just explode onto it. And so I've begun the revision process now, and it's just flowing right out, and I'm it's pretty strong. I'm just making it beautiful now.
And so this is something that we hope will be published in the next year or two?
I hope so, yeah. It takes quite a bit more time to write a novel than it does to write a poetry manuscript.
Right.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time. You have to know everything.
And meanwhile, you are teaching and also doing the kind of work that you just described in your poems, in your poem.
Yes, exactly. I work with my brother on that. Him and I started a couple businesses together over the years, and I like to work with my brother because, you know, that's my brother. Got to help him out as much as I can.
Jason Yersick is a poet and playwright, and he will be giving a reading along with Robert Mirabal on Friday, July 10th in Taos at 7:30 at the Taos Art Plaza. For more information, you can contact, or you can just go to the website, somostaos.org, or call area code 575-758-0081 for more information. Jason Yersick, it's a pleasure to have you on the show again, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to introduce Chef Johnny V. He's a food writer. He's a food editor for the Santa Fe magazine. He's the author of the book Cooking with Johnny V, International Cuisine with a Modern Flair.
Ooh-hoo.
He runs the cooking school at Las Cosas. He's on the web at chefjohnnyv.com and so much more.
He's everywhere.
It's great to have you.
Nice to be here. Welcome back from Bali.
Ah, yes. Thank you.
Was it fabulous?
Well, I'll tell you what. I ate better there than I have eaten in years.
Really? I know.
And, you know, who knew? I had better digestion in Bali than I've had
really?
In many years. Who knew that fried noodles could do that
I know,
for
really.
You?
Must be all the mangoes you're eating, right?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. But you have had a life in food.
I really have. It's interesting. I actually originally wanted to go into show business. And
were you a singer?
Yeah, when in high school I did musicals and stuff. And then went to college. Actually did some theater, but also restaurant management. But I still thought I'll still move to New York and become an actor on Broadway. And then when I moved to New York, I suddenly realized that most of the other people that I worked in restaurants with were all actors waiting to be on Broadway. So I thought, maybe I'll stick with the career I'm educated in. And kind of started at the bottom of the feeding chain,
the food chain, if you will.
I had my little degree with me from a restaurant management school, moved to New York, thought I was going to be running restaurants, and then immediately was sent back to the kitchen to start doing dishes. So with my little degree posted above the dish machine,
I started
at the bottom of the career. But it was fun.
Not that you want to wash dishes for your whole life, or most people don't, but, you know, then you always have empathy for the dishwashers.
Yeah, and you need to, I think people need to understand the whole system. Some of the kids that go to school, they sort of go to a school and then they come out and they get drawn into this management leading position and they don't really realize how the whole restaurant runs from front to back.
Exactly.
So I think it was kind of a well-rounded experience. I worked in the back of the house. I worked as a manager. I worked as a chef. I worked as a waiter, bartender, and you really get a full understanding and then you have a sympathy for everybody and you see how it all comes together. So I think that's been a great experience. And then it's been interesting for me because of working in restaurants and managing restaurants and teaching about cooking. And then now later in my career to be writing about food and sort of even reporting on the food scene. You know, I realize that I'm sort of observing this phenomenon as well as participating in it. So it's kind of cool. I this past year consulted on a restaurant here in Santa Fe called A La Mesa. That opened last year, I guess in September, but just as a consultant that really hit the ground running, really took off. We found a wonderful chef from Las Cruces that we brought up and stuff. And I hadn't really worked in a restaurant for almost about 10 years. But it was interesting to sort of see how things had changed, how the Santa Fe food scene has changed. And I think you and I were talking about how we stay motivated. It's interesting because the food scene is constantly changing. So it never really gets boring because some new ingredient comes out.
New ingredients come out?
Yeah, you know, like 5 years ago, I didn't know what za'atar is, for example.
I don't know what za'atar is.
Za'atar. It's a Middle Eastern spice. It's actually a mixture of sesame seeds, thyme, sumac, edible sumac. And in the Middle East, it's used on a lot of different dishes, but it only suddenly became available over here. Have you had smoked Spanish paprika?
No.
All of a sudden, every recipe you see has smoked Spanish paprika.
So it's not like they were recently invented, but they were recently brought in as a fad or a new thing.
Yeah, like it's been in Spain, I think, for a long, long time. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have all these great tapas restaurants, for example. So James Campbell Caruso from La Boca started using smoked Spanish paprika. And then people say...
I would just like to say that La Boca is fabulous.
I love it. I love it. I'm also writing stories or chef's interviews for Local Flavor magazine. And on Thursday this week, I'm going to interview James for upcoming issues. So he's amazing. And that restaurant opened with a bang, and I still think it's right up there. I think it's
interesting. Yeah, they just changed their menu the other day.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's... creative. I think he's got his finger on the pulse of what's happening. So it never gets boring. Whereas the day-to-day, you know, if you have a job where every day it's the same thing, I think you become...
Yeah, I mean, if you were working in a place where the menu never changes and where you didn't invent the menu in the first place, that'd be hard.
You're just flipping... Well, flipping burgers, I suppose, could be fun. That was one of my early jobs. It was actually a riot, you know.
I scooped ice cream cones for a period of
Do you remember going home with the ice cream all over your arms?
You
and
had
stuff.
Ice cream in
everywhere.
Your clothes, in
yeah,
your shoes,
and you
in
always
your
smell
hair.
Like, yeah, you smell like dairy.
I you know,
always
you smell like
dairy.
Even after a shower. It's very strange. But the, I mean, another thing about food is that there have been a lot of movements that intersect with ecological movements, organic food, local food.
Yep, farm-to-table movement and stuff. Another cool thing I got involved with this past year is I became a mentor for the Cooking with Kids program in the public schools. And this was an interesting, one of the people on the board of the Cooking with Kids program had the idea of involving professional chefs. I think it's been in the school for about 12 years in the schools here. And they go to the schools all through the year and introduce topics to the kids. Where in a lot of schools, the kids actually cooked. Like once a week, the entire school gets to do a class. So they brought in some professional chefs. And we're now, you know, giving it a little bit of a new spin and stuff. And we go and help the kids cook. And when you see these little kids getting excited about food and learning about healthy food, and it's partially funded by the American program for the schools. So nutrition and you know, healthy diets are involved in the stuff we teach the kids. And it's really good because the kids, like, totally get into it. And they learn where food comes from, which there's a whole generation of kids that...
Yeah, they thought food came from cans.
Yeah. And, like, you know, I grew up in the 50s, and food really did come from cans,
well,
you know.
Yeah.
You know, so it's fun. But it keeps me interested. You know.
Oh, so what are they teaching kids about nutrition these days? When I was growing up, there were four food groups. Then there was this rather cryptic pyramid for a while.
Which now we're realizing should be upside down. You know,
I never got that food pyramid thing.
No.
It seemed like the four food groups made more geometrically complicated.
Well, and the tricky thing was I think a lot of those food groups were funded by the Beef Council, the Dairy Council.
Right.
I don't think basically... kids should drink as much milk as you and I were made to drink, you know? Milk's really hard to digest. Anyway, I think they're trying to teach kids balance. You know, it was crazy 10 years ago. There were, you know, vending machines with soft drinks in every school in the country.
I was going to say, have they gotten that out
of the
schools?
I think they finally are getting them out of there.
Yeah.
And even the, you know, the school lunch program was always pretty dicey when we were growing up, you know.
Well, I mean, I remember when Ronald Reagan announced that ketchup was a vegetable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we used to have pizza every Friday and fish sticks. You know, what are fish sticks?
Well, that was the Catholic thing.
Yeah. So now it's like, I think it's all...
What
are fish sticks?
That's a non-rhetorical question.
Mystery meats, all those, you know. So it's good to see the kids. And then I'm actually right today on the second day of my kids' cooking camp at Las Cosas, where I have 9 kids that are, I guess, 7 through 12 that we do every day. We do a 2.5-hour class, so... And what you discover is if you inspire kids and also get them, if you capture their imagination, they're so into it. And they get so excited about it. I had 2 little girls that came yesterday, and they weren't sure they were going to be able to come for the whole week. And the mother came in this afternoon and said, yesterday, the girls on the way home were like,
So what are you teaching them? How advanced does it get? I mean, another theme worthy of discussion is the fact that people don't seem to understand how much kids can learn. They can learn a lot of, and for me, especially having been in Bali, where you see these people who are 7-year-old expert wood carvers who've had a hammer and chisel in their hands since they were toddlers.
Yeah.
I mean, kids can do a lot of things. What are you teaching them?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of parents say, so do you do like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches? And I'm like,
Exactly. Kids
are so far beyond that.
Yeah.
Today we made pad thai, and we ask all the kids, what's your favorite food? They're like, we love pad thai. So I try to turn it back to the kids and find out what they like to do. They want to make sushi. And I think a lot of times
How old are these kids?
They're like 7 through 13.
Excellent.
But some of the kids, I mean, I think kids that have bad diets, a lot of times it's what our parents are feeding them, you know.
Well,
and kids are groovier than that. They want to know. They know about foreign, different types of exotic foods. I always laugh. I don't think I had sushi till I was 30, you know.
Right.
But kids that are like 10 now get sushi one night a week and stuff. So we do all adult themed menus. Yesterday we did Mexican food. We did tortillas. We made three different salsas, guacamole salsa. Today we did more noodle-based dishes. So we made pasta, we made meatballs, tomato sauce, pad thai, and just like things that we know the kids will be able to go home and teach or cook in their family setting. A couple years ago, I've been doing this also for 10 years, I had two little kids from California whose grandmother registered them for the kids camp because they were being raised by a single mom who only ever fed them from a drive-up window.
Oh, boy.
And the kids, the two little boys, they were 7 and 9, didn't know that lettuce started out as a head of lettuce.
Right.
It was always handed to them. And they also didn't really know how to sit at a table and eat. But by the end of the week, they started making that connection. They saw lettuce, even if they were eating hamburgers, they saw a hamburger started out
right.
something different, and it's transformed. And they got excited about it. It was really cool. And I thought, good, maybe it's enough to inspire them to say, you know, Mom, let's do this stuff from home.
Right.
You know, so.
And maybe they'll do a little bit
yeah,
of it
yeah.
for her.
Yeah, yeah. And these kids, they're helpful and they're excited. And, you know, one little kid, I asked the kids what their favorite food is and their least favorite food. And one little kid last year said he didn't like arugula. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, my mom always buys arugula. And then one day we took him to the farmer's market and there was a big, beautiful bowl of fresh farm-picked arugula. And I gave him a spoonful and I said, taste this. And he said, oh, my God, I guess I do like arugula.
Right.
You know? So they're interesting. Like you said, kids listen. They know what's going on. So many kids watch the Food Channel.
Right.
One woman came in today and said her granddaughter watches the Food Channel. And she's like 6 years old and she watches it instead of watching cartoons, you know.
Right.
So the kids are getting
so
more savvy.
So she knows how to yeah. chop up garlic.
Yeah, and she wants to, you know, make these interesting dishes. And my parents, I grew up with a lot of our dishes started with like Campbell soup, you know.
Right.
Campbell soup casseroles. And now kids are like, they all knew what vegetable stock was today. You know, like, you know, oh, yeah, yeah, we use that all the time. So
that's so interesting. I mean, you go into real social troughs,
yeah.
the 1950s and 60s, better living through chemistry, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like, oh, the excitement of not having to guard.
Convenience, yeah.
Yeah, convenience of taking yeah. everything out of cans. And
yeah.
and now we're on the way back up.
And now, yeah, and it's cool. And I think with the farm-to-table movement, with our beautiful farmer's market here, chefs, I think, are becoming more involved in stuff. So it's interesting to watch the journey of the restaurants in Santa Fe as well, because they've got to roll with the trends and keep things. And it's interesting for me also to interview the chefs because I hear a little bit about what's going on in their heads and where they're taking the food scene. You know, some of them aren't on board with what's happening, and so they, I think, can fall behind with, you know, fresh food and people want healthier foods and stuff. So,
and so there's actually a demand for that. In other words, people know what restaurants serve fresh and farmers market food, and they choose
yeah.
to go there.
And they love to see chefs shopping at the farmers market. You know,
right?
Like Moo from Udu Noodles will be there.
Right.
And then she's actually creating her specials based on what she found there. You know, and I do get a lot of press releases because I'm a writer from chefs that say, you know, chef so and so, you know, searches the farmer's market for the foods he's going to cook on the menu that night. And we make jokes because one of the big food companies here is called Sysco that delivers everything, you know.
Right.
And we see the Sysco truck pulling out from the restaurant, you know. Like, gee, I wonder if the chef got some of his food from the farmer's market or is it coming from Sysco? But, you know, I think a lot of chefs locally really are focused on that, you know, dedicated to it. So,
we're talking,
know, it's funny.
We're talking to Chef Johnny V. Now, what are your, I have to ask you this, most and least favorite foods?
Interesting. Lima beans, I think, are my least favorite. For some reason,
I'm with you there.
Frozen, we probably had them frozen or canned.
I think a lot of people have, like, 1960s and 70s lima bean trauma.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like they're mealy and sort of. Although somebody said, well, have you ever had them with bacon on them? And that, you know, anything with bacon
well,
on it.
I have a bumper sticker on my refrigerator that says bacon makes everything better.
Yeah, I love that. It's so true. My favorite is actually, and it's in my cookbook, a dish called pasta puttanesca.
That's
which
good
is
stuff.
A spicy tomato sauce with olives, capers, and anchovies. I always make jokes that I have a salt lick next to my bed. So the saltier the food, the better, you know. So
a lot of people don't like anchovies.
I know. And I think they got overused, but I always laugh because in restaurants, you know, a lot of times people say, could we get the Caesar without the anchovies? And you always tell the people, absolutely. And then the anchovies, if they're already in the dressing, you just still bring the people the salad with the anchovies.
And they don't notice it in the dressing.
It's a mental thing, you know. It's like.
Yeah, well, I think they are an acquired taste. I mean, yeah. I acquired that taste somewhere in, late childhood or so.
I don't think I'd pick an anchovy up probably and necessarily eat it, but I love it. And, you know, the Italians are fabulous with how they use ingredients. They use anchovies for salt. I mean, they will actually drape a pork roast with anchovies and let it roast, and the anchovies fall apart and disappear, but it leaves this extra flavor. Have you heard about umami? You know, the fifth flavor, we have hot, sweet, salty, sour, and now we have umami. And I think it started in Japan, even in the 60s. So umami is a sense of flavor that is not hot, sweet, salty, sour, but it is a flavor of richness. So like soy sauce, which is also salty, also has that umami in it.
So it anchovies, translates as richness.
Richness and meatiness, even if it isn't a meat-based flavor.
Huh.
So chefs have now, you'll start to see, are trying to introduce the flavor of umami in their cooking.
But is it its own flavor, or is it a quality of other flavors?
It's really a quality of other flavors, but it's given a separate, if you can identify it with your palate, it's sort of a separate kind of little oomph.
Huh.
And I've noticed, like one of the soy sauce companies is using umami in their ads now. Find the flavor of umami, you know, in our soy sauce. So it's interesting, and it's fun to create recipes for kids that teach them about ingredients and teach them some skills. We are letting them use real knives today, so I'm always like, oh God, be careful with the knives. But you know, we teach them safety in the kitchen and how to not to get burned and be careful, and they're great. They really, you know, I say, you know, be focused when you're using these things. And I want them to have fun, because a lot of kids, I've met adults whose parents were very strict about them being in the kitchen when they were kids. And a lot of times those are picky eaters, and they're people that hate to cook because their mother or father, you know, terrorized them in the kitchen. Don't make a mess. Don't do this. Don't do that. And so I like to give kids creative license, and then within parameters.
Right.
Be creative, but let's not.
Well, and the things that you learn when you are that age stay with you forever.
Yeah.
I didn't learn cooking as a kid at home, and I learned a little bit in home ec class, which I don't think they have anymore.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've always been able to do is make a perfect pie crust
because
the wonderful Miss Sheldon taught us that.
Yeah, and that stay with you. And, you know, nowadays it's also cool.
But I wish it were a lot of other things.
Yeah. But, you know, it's cool now that I have, like, five little boys in my class. And kids are, like, you know, kids are starting to realize it's actually cool to cook. You know, boys, that it's cool to cook.
And you get girls that way.
Yeah, and you totally get girls that way. And one of the little kids, last year, we divide into groups when we're cooking. And we decided that the boy team was going to make desserts. And one of the little girls said, oh, we don't want the boys to make dessert. Boys can't cook. And one of the little boys said, hey, that's sexist. He was 9. Hey, that's sexist. You know?
So, excellent.
Yeah. So we try to keep them all going. And, you know, it's a great week. But I don't know how people have kids. I don't know how the Waltons did it with 9 kids or whatever. And Kate and John, I don't know how they do it. You were probably gone.
You're dating yourself.
I so am. I really.
The Walt, that was the 70s.
Really. Yeah, so it's fun. But and then also it's interesting because when I'm teaching adult classes, I see a lot of sort of leftover bad habits from, you know, the adults when they were children and stuff. And people that are timid about cooking or shy, or I try to not to make anybody feel like they can't do it.
Right.
We always want people to be successful. So we do 3 classes a week at Las Cosas, and all different topics all over the Thai. In fact, I have a class coming up on Peking duck, where we make Peking duck, where you dry the duck with a fan and stuff.
And make
2 different types of pancakes. And we do a lot of New Mexico themed classes. We're doing a green chili class this Saturday to get people ready. Green chili's not out yet, but get people ready. So that's fun. And then being able to write about it and interviewing chefs, you know, I really feel like I've got my fingers on the pulse because I talk to so many different people, you know, about what they're doing. And so chefs between each other, not that they're competitive, but they don't necessarily share their secrets between
right.
chefs. But because if I get to interview them, you know, ideally I get to open them up and get them to
share
tell me
recipes.
What they're doing. Yeah, share the recipes and tell me what makes them tick, which is these articles I'm doing in Local Flavor. We're calling it At the Table with Johnny V. And it's sort of like we go out to dinner together and I pick their brain, watch them eat, find out what they like, what makes them tick.
Right.
Rather than just where did you go to school and what was your first thing you cooked when you were a child. I want to go a little deeper than that.
I think there's a kind of creativity in every art form. And in cooking, one of the things that I so admire, and it's a gift that I don't have myself, is the ability to figure out maybe two or three or four ingredients that you don't usually put together, but that go beautifully together. It's easy, sometimes
yeah.
even fast, but it makes something that is more than
so
the sum
special.
Of its parts.
Yeah. Like, for example, you know, tomatoes and basil. There's so many things you can do with that, including just chopping it up and putting it over pasta, you know. And basil is such a fragrant dish, and herb, and you can grow it, and it's not expensive. And when tomatoes come out, I'm very lucky. I live next door to a couple that love to grow the most fabulous tomatoes. And, you know, tomatoes don't really come in till August at best. And they always leave me a couple of fabulous tomatoes on my front porch. And I work a lot, so it's not like I'm home working in my
tending
garden.
Tending the garden,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. People might think that I do that. But, you know, it's fun to just to take that and let that be the basis for what you're creating. You know, be inspired, by just like an artist is.
Yeah.
An artist sees a sunset or a mountain or a color.
Right.
And then they run with it. So, but the restaurant business, you know, apart from the creativity of chefs in Santa Fe, it's also a business, and
yeah.
it's a crunching business.
It's a competitive business, and
very
it's a business with not a whole lot of profit margin.
Yeah, profit margin, and your whole life is wound up in it. Incredible hours. It's tough on relationships. You know, it's brutal, and I think you've got to love it. I mean, I think if it was an industry you didn't love, I think you'd get out of it.
Do chefs tend to eat as well as their clients, as well as their customers?
I think chefs have probably the worst eating habits of anybody I know.
That's what
yeah.
I knew a chef who ate horribly, and I couldn't believe it, and I hoped that he was the exception.
Yeah, no, I think, and I have a little thought that the reasons chefs may drink too much is when you're cooking all day long and tasting things, like you're tasting sauces, you're tasting little bits of dressings and stuff, your flavors or your appetite is being satisfied, but you haven't actually had enough calories for the day. So at the end of the night, you're still hungry, but you're not hungry for food flavors. So drinks, beer, and, you know, help you unwind and stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of chefs tend to overdo it because you're still hungry at the end of the night. Or you go home and knock off a whole pizza.
Right.
And people think, oh, he must be eating foie gras every night. And it's like, oh, no.
They don't really have a meal. Because a lot of good restaurants, they will serve their wait staff
yeah.
the meals that they make.
Yeah.
Not only because they should know what it is that they're serving to their customers,
yeah.
but also because a well-fed,
happy
wait person will stay with you and they won't steal food.
And I think chefs also always eat standing up. Even managers, when I've managed restaurants, I don't think I ate a hot meal
sitting down
for 5 years because you're always, you know, a phone call comes, there's a problem, you've got to get up and go help somebody. And so I think going out to dinner is the best thing, or the best part of this job, is because it's great when somebody else does it for you. And, you know, people say to me, oh, my God, we couldn't cook for you because you're a chef. And I'm like, you know what? When I cook all day long, if you throw me a chicken or a Frito pie that I didn't have to participate in, it's such a great gift, you know.
Johnny V is a chef, food writer. He's editor for the Santa Fe and Magazine. He's author of the wonderful cookbook, Cooking with Johnny V, International Cuisine with a Modern Flair. He runs the cooking school at Las Cosas, and his website is chefjohnnyv.com. That's chefjohnnyvee.
Yep.
So the V is spelled out.
VEE.com.
Johnny, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It was delightful. I'll see you soon.
Okay.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Ruby Braff, Paul Smith, and Ralph Sutton.